I am filled with awe and inspiration at what I've kind of beheld in this sort of esteemed role I get to play in our shared experience here, just to be part of the circles and be witness to so many amazing experiences. Such honesty, such wisdom and compassion, and so much that we've kind of discovered together. I'm truly honored. I thought maybe in the name of this sort of honesty and self-revelation, I might start off and read a few more of those confessional tweets, just to... There's so these wonderful snippets of just honesty. They're quite wonderful. Sandwich shop cashier, what's your name? Me. Oh, I have a boyfriend. Cashier, it's for the sandwich. Pulled into a gas station and was on the wrong side of the pump for my gas cap. And drove around to the other side and did it again. Drove away. Now I can't go back. Bought preparation H for under eye bags. Told the clerk told the clerk she didn't need to bag it because I was going to use it in the car. And this one's my personal favorite. On a trip, saw some baby horses. Could not think of the word foal. Finally shouted, horse kittens. Wife understood. To me, those are just so delightful because they're just so honest and self-revealing. And it's such a reflection of our practice, is being present and being honest and having the moment revealed. And this journey we've been on really fits quite neatly into the archetype of the hero's journey. I wanted to talk a little bit about the journey. And there are many different steps, but in essence, it really comes down to heeding the call. And once you set out on your journey, there are setbacks and there are trials. And on your journey, there are insights and there are glimpses of truth. And on the journey, there's the return. We have a call inward, and we also have a call outward. Mary Oliver, it's one of her more well-known poems. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations through their melancholy was terrible. It was already light enough in a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voice behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice which you slowly recognized as your own. I kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. And you know that calling, don't you? Can you remember back to when the first glimmer of a thought came up that maybe you would take this retreat, take some time of intensive practice? Just that sense there was something here that was calling you, that you knew you had to do. And do you recall what you said about the retreat to your friends? Or were there people you didn't talk about this retreat because they wouldn't get it? Someone told his mother he was going on a meditation retreat. Later, he heard that she was telling her friends that he was going to Club Med. It's this great story of these two guys are talking, and one guy says, "How's your son doing? I understand he's taking a break from college." And this guy says, "Well, he's going to a meditation retreat." And his friend said, "Well, at least he's not sitting around doing nothing." But that call is something quite miraculous. It's some wisdom faculty that resonates. And it's one thing to feel and hear the call, and it's another thing to act. And a deep bow to acting on that, as well as to the resilience that you have brought to this retreat. And the Buddha's life is a wonderful allegory for the hero's journey. He too felt the call. Many of us are familiar with the story of the Buddha living a protected life. And he is exposed to the four heavenly messengers. As a young man, he sees someone who's sick, someone who's old, and someone who's dying. And he'd never seen this before. And it's explained to him that this happens to everyone. And then he sees a sannyasi. He sees a renunciate. This one man who had nothing and yet seemed radiant, and had a conversation with him. And he felt that call. And for many of us in our lives, there's a moment when we realize that we're caught, that we've exchanged our freedom in order to belong. And there we feel we hate our jobs, but it pays the bills. And these questions keep coming through. Whose life am I living? Am I living out the program and programming and the expectations of my primary caretakers and my family and my culture? How much of my life am I just living out of reactivity? We feel caught up in the conditioning, and we sense there's something more. And we know we have to go. And we step out into those proverbial 40 days and nights in a desert of not knowing. And as the Buddha recognized, we're looking for happiness in all the wrong places. We're looking to find lasting happiness in things that aren't permanent, like building a skyscraper on sand. It just doesn't work. And so taking refuge in material things will not make you happy. And so we set out, and as Joseph Campbell says, we sense that the goal of life is to make our heartbeat match the beat of the universe, to match your nature with nature. And so the Buddha set out on his path. He snuck out of the palace and underwent all kinds of trials. He took on practice of great austerity. He took on many, many practices, gave himself fully, and realized that they fell short of what he was seeking, of what he was looking for. And when you reflect back over your journey this week, and when you reflect back to the hardest moments you've had, the most difficult times, when you reflect on the struggle, the aversion, being lost in planning, caught up in the endless cycles of worry, caught in heaviness, sloth, doubt, cloudiness, caught in fear, paralyzed by the ruthless critic, the periods of confusion. There are times when I'm on retreat and I sometimes just think like, what am I supposed to do here? There's just that sense of, where do I start? And there's something about the resilience that is so powerful. Remember as a kid, on our black and white TV that got 2.5 channels, once seeing the movie Jason and the Argonauts, if you remember that one. It was one of the first movies with special effects. And I remember the scene where he's doing the sword fight with the skeletons, and I was just taken over by that. But I also remember the scene where, and it's the scene from Odysseus where they're passing the sirens, maybe the Isle of the Sirens, and he instructs his crew to lash him to the mast, and they fill their ears with wax and they cover their eyes, and he's lashed to the mast, and as they're sailing by the island, these incredible, beautiful calls that are just tormenting them in their beauty and wanting to go there. And that's so much of our experience. The times when you're present and you're just called off to these wonderful castles that you're building and planning and to wild fantasies. Perhaps you've had those moments where you wake up in meditation and realize you're lost in a fantasy. And then you make the decision, I'm just going to go with this. It just feels good. But even if you do, you wake up again. The fantasy dispels and you're back. And so when you're here, you set your stake in the here and now. You're pounding your stake in the here and now. And then the trials begin. As Joseph Campbell says, opportunities to find deeper powers within yourself come when life seems most challenging. And no doubt there have been times when you have had to dig deep, or you have tapped into something that you didn't know was there, in order to keep your heart and your mind open and present. That stake in the here and now, that non-judging awareness. And then here comes the weather. The aversion, the craving, the worry, the sloth, the torpor, the doubt, the fear. And then the eight worldly winds. These winds that, as you move through life, are buffeting you all the time. The chasing after fame and praise and pleasure and being a winner, and then running away from all the winds that have to do with shame and blame and pain and loss. I've met so many incredibly successful people on this planet whose entire success was driven by the terror of failure. Success with no happiness. along with those weather systems from greed and hatred and confusion, the moments of inflation, the moments of deflation, the memories that come back, all of that. And so a deep bow for your resilience, for your staying with it. Absolutely inspiring for me. And there's this amazing paradox that begins to emerge where we find we're holding this wild paradox in our practice where you can be resilient and at the same time open-hearted. You can be deeply rested and at the same time alert. That you can cultivate a state of seeing clearly and at the same time be receptive to what's here. And that's what sets the stage for transformation and for insight. And so the Buddha engaged to all kinds of practices, and many of them at the outset of his practice were practices of austerity, of denying the body and staying present to that. And in one of the classic stories, he decided to cut back on food, eating one grain of rice less a day until there was nothing. Being weak, losing consciousness. A young woman from another caste offered him some milk. And he received it and was revived. And his fellow practitioners were upset with him. He broke his fast. And he broke a precept by accepting food from someone from another caste. And in that moment, in my sense, he recognized that this was his path. This was his knowing. And he made a break from traditional practice, a repudiation of the caste system. Recognizing as well that awareness does not awaken through denial of the body. Neither does it awaken through indulging the body. But this beautiful articulation of the middle way, not too tight, not too loose, and recognizing that cultivation of this delicate balance. His insights were directly informed through his practice and through his direct experience. And so your path, your journey is informed by your direct experience. And it's your resilience that has awakened this knowing and seeing that you have. So many powerful stories this week, recognizing the practices that resonate for you, and sensing the resistance to a practice and moving through that resistance and having a new insight or a new awakening or a shift of some kind. And there's one thing I love about this particular way of practicing. And again, my understanding of classic Buddhism scriptures is not complete. I always fall back to saying something the Buddha allegedly said, because who knows what he really said. But the words that I heard is this understanding that no one is going to save you. That you, in your journey, have to take responsibility for your own awakening. When I first heard that, it was a little shocking, because there's sort of a sense of like, just tell me what to do and I'll be okay. But that's not what this is. This is about giving yourself fully to a practice and then evaluating, deeply evaluating for yourself, finding out what is true, what resonates for you. in the Buddha's practice and the different, as he refined his own practice that worked for him. And there's this language of nirvana. And one of the definitions of nirvana is a snuffing out. It's like blowing out a candle. And the question is, what is it that's blown out? And one way to think of it is that what is blown out is greed and hatred and delusion. In the absence of greed, in the absence of hatred, and in the absence of delusion, what's left? Many have spoken of the impact of the practice that Tara led this morning, which embraces this sense of the paradox of intimate, detailed presence to the here and now, and yet opening to the space that holds it. And I thought we might just do a brief meditation, a brief centering, and I'd like to kind of refresh a sutta that she shared. So you might, as you close your eyes, you might note how much more readily now your attention moves from the outer world to the inner world. You might notice how much more readily you gather your awareness in the aliveness of here and now. You may notice as well your capacity to feel more intimately the aliveness of the senses, the sounds, how subtly you can feel the movement of the breath inside, perception of vibration, tingling, pulse, smell, taste. And you may sense as well this opening into the recognition of who you are as the one who is aware. The space that contains the aliveness here. And you might reflect on these following lines. Utterly awake. Sense doors wide open. Utterly open, non-fixating awareness. And deepening the breath. You might gently open the eyes or feel free to remain with them closed if you prefer. In this journey, as we set our stake in the present moment, as we're more aware of the winds, all the forces that pull us away, there are sometimes glimpses. Sometimes these moments of just sensing intuitively who you are in the absence of, of wanting, who you are in the absence of pushing away, that sense of clear presence. And it is revealed through our practice. It's been said that a retreat like this is not so much a place where you learn. It's more of a place where you let go. One teacher described it as a gigantic garbage disposal. We're letting go and letting go and letting go. And so the paradox of practice, rested and alert, intimately present to the granularity of here and now and opening to the space that contains it, aware of the sounds and the space, the silence behind the sounds, aware of the bird and aware of the sky that the bird is flying through, aware of the suffering and aware of how the suffering breaks the shell around the heart and can open us to wisdom. So the question is, where do these glimpses and these insights lead? And you could say they lead to an awakened mind. This capacity to recognize what is true, transcendent of your preference, your story, your embellishments, what's actually true. But they also lead to an awakened heart, to this heart that can hold what is here. And so we look to the classic teachings. What do the classic teachings point to in this practice? Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do unto others as they would have you do unto you. See self and other in self. Be a well-wisher of all. Be kind to the young, the sick, and the dying, as one day you too will be one of these. Meeting suffering with a kind heart. And so there is this calling inward, but also in a journey, there is a calling to the return. And the question is, when you come to the end of the journey inward, how do you move into the world out there? It's a very deeply, deeply personal inquiry. And just as a reminder, tomorrow is the final day of the retreat. And you have some options. One of them is not to leave. I found a place behind the hay bales, behind the goats. It might keep you there for a couple days before they find you. But the other option is to reflect on what calls you, on how to be, on what will support you as your journey continues beyond here. So as you've been on retreat, the rest of the world has not been on retreat. They've been leaving you emails and voicemails and the clashing and banging and shouting and yelling and repressing in the world has still gone on during this week. And after the Buddha's awakening, he also returned. And at first, according to the stories, he did not want to go. As the story goes, he rested in that awakening. And then there was a deep reluctance. And part of it was, who could ever get this? Who could understand this? Because he saw that everyone was looking for happiness in exactly the wrong direction. How do you find happiness that is not dependent on externals? And then, as the story goes, he thought, well, there are a few people I know who only have a little dust in their eyes. That's the translation. Only a little dust in their eyes. And so he began to share. And the rest of his life was walking on foot and sharing. There's a misconception that many people have, and a misconception that I had, that after the Buddha's awakening, it was a time of unprecedented peace and prosperity and ease. And no, not at all. Throughout his life, the dukkha continued around him. There were wars and conflict with relatives fighting on either side. As he was cultivating communities to support people in their practice, there was infighting and power struggles and incredible conflict around him. And it was a mess. And much of his life was working with all the struggle and all the suffering that people were creating for each other. And one thing that occurs, and we think we've shared this line, that when you meditate, you feel better, you feel your rage better, you feel your sadness better, but you also feel the suffering of the world better. It's the good news and bad news. The good news is the heart feels more. The bad news is the heart feels more. And it is a really deep inquiry how to stay open to the cruelty in the world. The natural response is outrage and anger when we see the cruelty, the repression, the on and on and on. And the anger and outrage, it has to be seen clearly for what it is, because it points to the pain of the heart in really feeling the suffering out there. And that anger can be tremendous fuel for action. You ever notice how much housework you get done when you're really pissed? It's emotion, it's energy in motion. Speaking truth to power, standing up for the weak and the powerless, and those who have no voice, it is noble, and I bow deeply to those who are called into social action. And the challenge is how to convert the anger and the outrage in a way that will allow you to be as effective as you can be. And this is really about the wise heart in action. And when I hear the stories of those who have effected global change, I can't quite imagine how they made that transformation. Mahatma Gandhi, thrown off a train because of his color, sitting on the train tracks, trembling with outrage. How did he convert that into the Satyagraha movement, a nonviolent movement through an entire continent that changed planetary consciousness? I get goosebumps right now just thinking about it. When Martin Luther King's house was firebombed, he was ready to give up. And something inside said, you need to go on. And he managed to convert that suffering into a force that again has transformed our consciousness as a planet. Nelson Mandela determining to love his torturers. When they would have to bring in different torturers because they couldn't do it anymore because of the love they felt from him. The stories of Tibetan monks being tortured, trying not to die so it wouldn't affect the karma of their torturers. the story in Pennsylvania of a man who storms into a school room with Amish children and kills some of those children. And the Amish community inviting the shooter's mother to come in her confusion and her hurt. I don't know how they do that. But as you reflect on your calling in the world, it can be helpful to reflect on how your wounds have the potential to be your gifts in the world. The neglected child who decides that they want to be there for other people and steps into that helping role. Someone recovering from addiction and in their recovery makes a vow to be there for anybody who needs support in their recovery. The stories I've heard of those who grew up in unstable households who are deeply committed to creating new possibilities for their children. Reflecting on our lives and how our hearts have been touched and hurt, and how we can take that in the world, is a very powerful reflection. I grew up on a farm, and all through college, I co-managed a 1,000-acre farm. We had a hog operation, and I managed that livestock operation, where we raised animals and took them to the slaughterhouse. And the first time I backed up that big semi-truck and heard the anguish in that slaughterhouse was unbearable. I go back to that, and it's incredibly, incredibly painful. And as I sit with that, it then becomes, how can my actions be informed by that? Part of it is not just being vegan for myself, but how could I be a voice for those beings that don't have a voice? And so the question becomes, how do you step out into the world? And the interesting thing is, just as there's no one way to meditate, and I'm sure that's clear by now, there's no one technique that takes you all the way. There is no one way to be in the world and serve and give back. Your personal healing may be a call for more retreat. You may need to fill your cup before you can serve in the world. Your path may be to support your family to be as whole and complete as it can be. It may be to serve aging parents. It may be to serve and be out in the streets marching and getting arrested. It may be about standing up to injustice. It may be about giving voice to those who have no voice in this culture. It may be about working to create a new administration with new possibilities. But only you can determine what your path is. And it requires a deep, deep listening. Just as the call of the Buddha was to serve the awakening of others, it is an inherent in our nature. When the heart awakens, you can't not feel the suffering around you. And you can't not feel the quivering heart's response. And the question becomes, how? When we took our marriage vows, we took that occasion to craft kind of our version of the Bodhisattva vow. So our vows, may whatever arise serve the awakening of heart and mind and be of benefit to all beings. And I have to say, having that as an anchor has been tremendously helpful for me. In our relationship, when I feel separate and tight or judgmental or whatever it may this serve the awakening of heart and mind. It reframes it. It opens up new possibilities. There's a balance of heart and mind always. I grew up in a Quaker meeting during the Vietnam War. And as I like to say, I was exposed to a lot of really angry pacifists. And I have met quite a few truly, truly well-meaning and absolutely burned out social activists. So part of that Buddha's insight of the middle way is not too tight, not too loose. How do you fill your cup so that you can serve from a place of fullness rather than from a place of vacuum, of emptiness? Someone sent me this amazing photograph. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about this photograph, and then we'll have a little meditation. And the photograph is of a wolf pack. And so it's a long line of wolves as they're walking through the snowfield, you know, with the mountains in the background. Beautiful image. And it's entitled "Wolf Pack on the Move." Here's the description, and it's describing this line. The first three are the old or sick. They give the pace to the entire pack. If it was the other way around, they would be left behind, losing contact with the pack. In case of an ambush, they would be sacrificed. Then come five strong ones, the front line. In the center are the rest of the pack members, then the five strongest following. Last alone, the alpha. He, or maybe she, controls everything from the rear. In that position, he or she can see everything, decide the direction. He sees all of the pack. The pack moves according to the elder's pace, and they help each other. Watch each other. There's something about that image. Putting the elders first, putting the weak first, serving from the back, watching. And again, when we open to the paradox of the practice, rested and alert, intimately present, aware of the space, there is this incredible element of what's sometimes called the servant leader, where you can take leadership, you can step into power, you can make a difference in the world, informed through that lens of serving the whole. Let's close your eyes. As you place your stake in the here and now, you might reflect on all the winds that have buffeted you. This calling, however you may describe it, to increase your capacity for happiness. To be free. To have your heartbeat match the heartbeat of the universe. To have your nature match nature. And as you have arrived, taking some time to reflect on your journey, on the trials, the challenges, the setbacks. You may sense how, as you have sat with these challenges, how you have found deeper powers within yourself. Reflecting on the glimpses, the moments of clear seeing, a release. And sensing in your own way. As you reflect on the arc of your journey this week, sensing what is waiting for you. If you were to open into this awakened heart in this busy world, what enlivens you? What calls you? And letting there be a deep listening. Your path is revealed as you relax, as you open. And as you listen, as we reflect on the arc of this life. Just reflecting on these words from Wendell Berry. No, there is no going back. Less and less you are that possibility you were. More and more you have become those lives and deaths that have belonged to you. You have become a sort of grave containing much that was and is no more in time, beloved then, now, and always. And so you've become a sort of tree standing over a grave. Now more than ever, you can be generous toward each day that comes, young, to disappear forever, and yet remain unaging in the mind. Every day, you have less reason not to give yourself away. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.